friend's been dying to get on the radio, so can we take him? You've never talked to him, have you?
Never have.
See, Red Friend, how the heck are you?
Hey, guys, gentlemen, how fitting it is to have a man named Jordan on the show today. As we move towards our second dynasty, what a glorious day for the Bulls. I'm on cloud nine. Let me tell you how persuasive Doug Collins can be. In 1987, with the 10th pick, Jerry Krause wanted to draft a bum named Joe Wolf. Doug Collins wanted Horace Grant. Doug went to Reinsdorf, he went to Krause, and used his skills to change the mind of the obstinate and stubborn Jerry Krause. And the rest is history. Doug's voice will be loud, it's going to be influential, and non-believers should take solace in that. Doug Collins is going to be for the Bulls what Jerry West was for the Warriors. Are you guys pumped? I am. Come on, Sylvie. The big red Leviathan. It's being born now. Are you on board yet?
No.
Are you on board?
No.
Look, I'm always on board, and I hope they start making the right decisions, and I hope Doug can be persuasive when they want to sell Jordan Bell in the draft for $3.5 million.
How dare you? How dare you? Ooh. 2 years ago, guys, 2 years ago, 2017 had cap space.
Hey!
Last year, 14 teams had cap space. Hey! Next summer, 5 to 9 teams have cap space. You know who has the most? The beloved Bull. I'm on board. The big red train. Here we come.
There.
Are you on board? Quickest rebuild in history. 1 year. That's it. We're back.
1 year.
All right, Frank. Good stuff. There you go. Frank's doing cartwheels. And I love Doug. Doug Collins is great. And it's good to have him a part of the organization. How big of an impact it will make, I'm not sure.
I think he steps in and he's consulting with, I think it becomes him and Pax. I wonder how much weight Gar's going to carry here moving forward. I also do believe there's something to the fact that when free agency rolls around, this is a legitimate guy who can sell free agents on Chicago. Charismatic,
yeah.
Beloved by everybody, both players, coaches, a lot of them. I think there is something to it. I'm not like Fred there on that level, but I do think this is a small thing that is bigger than it appears.
No one's on C-Red Fred's level, but we love him.
What's going on? This is Joakim Noah, and you're listening to Chicago Bullseye.
Give it all you got. Take your very best shot and may the best team win. The time is now. The name of the game is action. They're on the floor and they're ready to score. So let the game begin.
I'm doing well, Fred. I think we're just weeks away from training camp, so about ready to start the season up again. Exciting times.
I know. People forget how much earlier the season starts this year, and it is exciting to see the beloved Bull are almost back in camp. Obviously, a much different team. Not going to be a contender, probably, in all likelihood, for a playoff spot. But still a year of transition, and hopefully will be as bad as possible to have that chance at Michael Porter Jr. I did want to start out along these lines, since we are geared for the lottery this season, with a little bit of talk on lottery reform. What's your take on the efforts by the NBA to reform the lottery? First of all, do you think it needs reform? And second of all, how do you think this affects the Bulls' plans?
Well, I do think that there are some changes that need to be made. Number one, to avoid tanking from teams. And fans want to see the stars play, regardless of what team it is or what time of the season it is. I remember when I first started going to NBA games way back in the day, when it was the Cincinnati Royals and Nate Archibald was just emerging as a star in the league. And even late in the season, we were going to see him play and his teammates. We weren't thinking about, gosh, where are they going to fall in the draft? Or, you know, we were just kids at the time, but you'd go to a game and expect to see the top players playing and the best players on the floor trying to win, regardless of what point of the season it was. Now, I'm sure there were situations where, you know, there were tanking-like situations, but not like you see today. So I think there does need to be some adjustments made for those reasons. And I had a couple of thoughts about ways they might be able to avoid the tanking situation and what they've talked about in terms of smoothing out the odds of the non-playoff teams. I'm all for that, actually. You know, kind of give everyone a shot, because really anyone that's not in the playoffs, for the most part, is having some problems, either due to injuries or just a bad roster or just an inept front office, which you shouldn't necessarily reward them. But I would like to see all the non-playoff teams have a very similar chance to get in the lottery. Excuse me, and get in for that number 1 to 5 pick. Give everyone a shot at it.
What
about you?
I kind of feel, I mean, it's a tough call for me. You know, like, I mean, I think it, for a lot of these small market teams, you really have only one chance of getting better, one chance of really competing and improving, and that's through the draft. A lot of guys aren't going to get any free agents. Indiana, the Oklahoma cities are unlikely to sign major free agents. And I think the draft is the only way they can get better. But it does what Philadelphia has done, I think, for the last 5 years. It's disgraceful. And everybody, you know, says it's a success. It's not remotely a success. The team still sucks. Yet they might be over 500 this year. I'm not sold on that. Their best player is completely injury prone. Who knows if he's going to be able to play a lot of games. They have injury-prone players up and down that roster. You know, it'll be interesting to see how they finish, but I'm not sold that they're going to turn things around. I'd like to see something like 1 through 5 have an equal shot, 6 through 10 a little bit less likely. That's in the lottery. Maybe to kind of narrow it down to prevent, you know, it's really not fair that a team like Miami didn't make the playoffs and has virtually no chance at a high lottery pick. And then a team like, you know, Philadelphia year in, year out is just tanking, and they get a chance for, you know, a high pick. I completely agree with a lot of what you said.
Right. Well, and I'm with you. I'm kind of astounded where people are talking about what Philadelphia has done as a success. I mean, am I missing something? I mean, I know they won 28 games last year, but these top players they've picked, like you said, have been injured most of the time, and their fan base has to be totally frustrated by the lack of success and the product that's been on the floor. I know they're selling it on this long-term vision, but the other thing is they're all still very young players, and I don't see any veteran free agents that would supplement that young roster, which is kind of the formula you need to really have success in the playoffs. I just don't see it. And I'm not ready for the big jump for Philadelphia. I mean, prove it to me, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. They added J.J. Redick. You know, I guess that's one good, you know, they signed him to a $22 million deal. But the praise for Sam Hinkie that I still hear is mind-boggling to me. It doesn't take talent. It doesn't take a lot of talent or intelligence to be bad. What does take intelligence is, you know, picking Porzingis, and he passed on him at three in that draft. So, you know, there's your opportunity to get better, you know, and I don't understand the love for what he did. You've lost 5 years. You've ruined the fan base support in general for the team. I mean, it's still going to be there. It's still Philadelphia, and they're still diehard fans. But you've really lessened the interest in that team and hurt the brand quite a bit. 5 years is far too long to be this bad. I think they've, you know, been over 500 once in like the last 10 years. So I don't know. I think that type of scenario, to me, it's stupid too. Because even if you're getting 3 or 4 high picks, eventually you're going to have to pay those guys. You can't pay all of them a max deal at once, right? You need to have 1 or 2 and then kind of structure it from there.
Right. Well, and we have seen glimpses of Embiid being a very talented pro and a big guy, but very small doses of that. Ben Simmons is a total unknown at this point, even though he's an intriguing talent. But we've already talked on past podcasts about his lack of success the 1 year he was at LSU. And, you know, if he's going to be a point forward, you know, a big point guard, that's a big leap to go from playing at LSU and not having postseason success to jumping into the NBA and having the ball in your hand. So I'm hoping what happens with the Bulls as they try to rebuild is that they play a lot of young guys, they're competitive, and kind of that spirit that Brett Brown, I think, has tried to introduce to the 76ers. As bad as they've been, they do compete, and, you know, the players are people you can kind of get behind. But I'm hoping the Bulls are scrapping and trying to win games, even though I think the goal is to not be so good so you get a very high pick.
Yeah, I guess when you think about it, it's not really fair. Look what Phoenix did last year, sitting their players, the Lakers sitting their players. And then you'll have a team that, you know, like Minnesota, that sucked but was actually really trying hard, playing their players in you know, an incredible amount of minutes, but in falling to seven, right? The effort was at least there for Minnesota, misguided as it was. You know, is it really right? Is it really fair for the health of the league? So maybe it is better that you kind of even out these opportunities or chances for number one overall. For the Bulls, however, you know, any type of reform is supposed to go into place for 2019. I think that's great. I think that the Bulls can quickly turn this around with a very high pick this year. If they hit on marketing and hit on a high pick this year and sign a player like Norland's Noel to kind of protect the rim and be a defensive force as a free agent next offseason, I think the Bulls can make a really quick turnaround. What say you?
I agree. I'm very concerned about the backcourt, though, with Dunn and Payne. Again, Payne's injured, so we may not see much of him. So I'm a little concerned about that. As far as up front, I still have hopes for Portis. Markkanen has looked really good in the FIBA EuroBasket games. And that's been a lot of positive energy in terms of what he might be bringing to the table. I know, as we talked about, it's kind of hard to find those games or find them online because of the time difference and just network. But those FIBA EuroBasket games are pretty fun to watch and pretty exciting. And the competition is solid. Granted, it's not NBA competition, but there's a lot of NBA players, or a lot of those players could certainly make NBA teams, but they're making better money playing overseas. So, I'm excited about the young core, although the backcourt worries me a little bit. A couple other thoughts as we were talking about lottery reform. And there's also a lot of talk, though, of elite players that weren't drafted in the top five. Right? I kind of compiled a quick list, and even I took a look at the all-pro teams from this past season. So, teams 1, 2, and 3. So 15 guys basically, right? The NBA first, second, and third teams. And 8 of those 15 guys were drafted number 7 or later. So over half of them. So it's not always about having that top 5 pick. So
it's a little misleading, though, because I did go back. I know exactly what you're talking about. The pro team is kind of dependent on position. So when you look at that, you have the centers like Rudy Gobert and players like that.
DeAndre Jordan was the 35th pick. Well, yeah, DeAndre. Gobert and Jordan are two really good examples of low picks.
That's exactly right. But in no way are those guys top 10 players. I wouldn't even call them top 20. You know, if you look at the top 20 players in the NBA, overwhelmingly, it's top 10 picks, often top 5 picks. And I think if you look at the top 10 players, I can't really think of anyone that was drafted, maybe Jimmy, if you want to put him at 10, that was drafted outside the top 10.
Well, Kawhi Leonard was 15, and Antetokounmpo was 15.
There you go. It's got the old deal. Those are two, no doubt. So we'll put those two in.
Which makes you wonder how so many teams missed on those guys.
Indeed, but it's still pretty rare to me. Like, I still feel like if you really want to get a game changer, LeBron James, Chris Paul, think about the greatest players in the NBA over the past 10 years. Almost overwhelmingly, they're number 1 through 5 picks. So it is, you do make a good point that the all-pro team did have a number, you know, Jimmy Butler and those type of players.
Right. Well, my point is that you can still find elite players later on in the draft, but you have to be a little lucky and pretty shrewd in your player evaluation. But I hear you. The LeBrons and the very, very top-tier guys, of course, are going to be top 5 picks.
Agreed.
Now, another thought I had on the lottery reform, and this idea I've heard tossed about, and is probably a little radical in some ways, but the thought of having the teams that didn't make the playoffs in a postseason tournament, like an NCAA tournament, you know, single elimination, to create a little drama. Now, I know there's some quirks to that of a team that maybe traded their pick, so what are they playing for, kind of thing. Kind of a more extended version of how in Major League Baseball, the winner of the All-Star game, National American League, gets to have home field advantage for the World Series, which to me is kind of outlandish, but that's the way it is. But that would create some excitement and drama for the non-playoff teams, and you could do it over a relatively short period of time and have that one-and-done drama like the NCAA tournament has. And I don't know how you'd eventually seed it in terms of, you know, other than the team that wins gets the top pick. The team that finishes second would get the second pick, and then how you work out the teams that get beat in the first round or whatever. You know, there'd be some other scale, or maybe based on their record, then it falls back to some other variable. But something like that, I think, would be interesting to give the teams that didn't make the playoffs some postseason experience and give their fans and an opportunity to get a little more excitement out of an end of a season.
Interesting idea. Yeah, very interesting. Unfortunately, but I do feel like this lottery reform is going to happen. Everything I have heard now, teams are going to move forward with it. I know before when it was discussed, teams like Oklahoma City were adamantly against it. I think that's now going to fall by the wayside. With that in mind, and let's say this does happen, does that, in your opinion, do you think that will change the Bulls' plans and they'll be far more aggressive in the free agent market next year than they might have been?
You know, that's hard to say. You know, I think the Bulls are a top-tier destination just based on their legacy and winning championships and being in a major market. And so I think the Bulls will be a player in free agency as well as through the draft. So that is one thing the Bulls certainly have going for them than other teams that are tanking. You know, I don't think, you know, maybe it, some point decades and decades ago, Philadelphia was a desired destination, but I wouldn't say it is anymore. Or even the Knicks are not that attractive of a draw for free agents, in my view, the way things have balanced out. I think the other overall concern with whatever happens with lottery reform or being able to retain players, we've touched on it, especially in the situations with Gordon Hayward and Paul George, giving up money, essentially, to go to the teams they choose. Well, and Durant, of course, too. But and so those are three players you could argue are playing in Tier 2 cities, not necessarily Tier 2 franchises, but I think the original plan was to make it so hard for those guys to walk away from the money that a Utah or an Indiana would be able to retain someone they've drafted and developed. And that obviously isn't the case. So I think that's also kind of a bigger problem in this situation with free agency and the lottery and how some of these quote-unquote small market teams can stay competitive.
No, agreed. Agreed. Let's move on to some discussion on Lauri Markkanen, who has, to me, been just an absolute tour de force in FIBA. Really impressive performances. I still hear the naysayers trying to, you know, downgrade what he's doing, comparing him to Nico. Nico never, ever came close to a sustained, you know, excellent play like Lauri has provided. He was also not even the best player in his own team. That was Pau Gasol for the Spanish national team. I'd like to get your opinion on what you've seen so far from him playing for Finland, leading them to several of these upsets over some pretty quality competition.
Right. Well, I haven't watched the full games, but I studied the highlight reels and extended highlight reels quite extensively. And the thing I've been impressed with, I knew he could shoot the ball, but to see him put the ball on the floor a few times and just the energy that he plays with, the positive energy. And, you know, it wasn't like his team was loaded with other either current or future NBA players, not that I could see. So, you know, even at his young age, he's kind of carrying the load for that team. So so I thought it was very, very encouraging, and that's a high level of basketball, and I think the NBA game is trending more toward that, you know, Euro style, right, where pace and space and the ball movement and, you know, and the big guys.
Exactly.
Playing, being able to play away from the basket. So I think all good signs for what Laurie's going to see in terms of playing at the NBA level. So
it was fantastic.
I think that was a real breath of fresh air for Bulls fans this summer.
Yeah, what was so exciting too is not that when how he scored, but when he scored down the stretch, key baskets in big games, getting to the free throw line, drawing fouls, passing. Every aspect of his game to me is better than advertised. That shooting, passing, he's a lot more athletic than I thought he was in studying the tape. He went aggressively to the hoop. I mean, the sky's the limit for this kid. I'm just ecstatic about what I've seen so far. So we may have found a real gem.
Yes.
Next one, Luka Doncic. Let's talk about him a little bit. He's predicted to be a top 5 pick in the NBA draft next season. He's had a real nice FIBA tournament. Love to get your little 411 on Luka. And what say you about his ability and future in the NBA?
Sure. Well, again, with the momentum on this story kind of started as the Bulls made their end of season moves and looked like they were lottery bound. So we started watching some of these top prospects even a little more closely. And the U.S.-based players I know quite well, but have been looking much more closely now at Doncic and the fact that he's still just 18, but putting up some impressive numbers at a young age in the Euro leagues, and reputation is growing. And today, Slovenia beat Spain in the semifinals of the Eurobasket. He played 35 minutes, had 11 points, 12 rebounds, 8 assists, and no turnovers. And Slovenia won the game and is in the finals now of Eurobasket. And that's playing against Spain with the Gasol brothers, Ricky Rubio, Sergio Rodriguez, the Hernan Gomez brothers. So not just
NBA talent. Yeah,
NBA talent. So, you know, and as I watch highlights of them, you know, I'm trying to get a feel for, he's kind of I see a little bit of Gallinari, maybe like a Chandler Parsons, Peja Stojakovic, but he's a little more dynamic about being able to put the ball on the floor. And so, yeah, certainly one to watch, and I can understand why his name is on that short list with Porter Jr. and Marvin Bagley and DeAndre Ayton and Mo Bamba and a few of the other top prospects. Miles Bridges, I think I'd like to put in there as well, of the top handful of prospects at this point for the draft of 2018.
No, I agree. I think Miles Bridges, too, has been a guy that's a little bit undersold. Incredible athlete. Just love his game. He'll be a sophomore. A little bit surprised he didn't come out last year. But I'd be shocked if he ends up not being a top 5 pick when all is said and done. What do you think of Miles Bridges?
I'm a big fan. I have seen him play in person. Freaky athleticism, kind of like the best of Michael Beasley. He's left-handed and has some size like that, but that can pull up and shoot jumpers as well as take it to the rack. And he's strong, really built, you know, broad shoulders, very strong and powerful. So I think he probably listened to some good advice in terms of another year of tough love under Tom Izzo and to develop his game. And kind of like Lute Olson used to say at Arizona, he didn't want guys to make an NBA team. He wanted the guys to have a career in the league. And sometimes that meant that having them stay in college another year or so to polish some of their skills to have that kind of career.
Great. What about, let's talk a little bit now about some of these great players that have passed over the last few weeks. We really haven't done this in a while, and I'd love to get your little history lesson for the fans about some of these great players that played the game and unfortunately passed on.
Right. Well, we kind of lost a mix of some legendary coaches and players over the summer, and as a basketball historian. I wanted to just give very brief capsules on each of them so fans of today that maybe aren't as familiar with these names or what some of their accomplishments were have an understanding of that, because the stars on the floor and coaching on the sidelines today have a lot to be owed to many of these guys. So I'll quickly kind of run through the list. In July, we lost Gene Conley, who, what's interesting about Gene Conley is he was probably the best two-sport basketball, baseball player of all of them. And there were other players, Danny Ainge, Dave DeBuscher, Ron Reed, you know, a number of them that tried playing two sports at the professional level. And typically one had better success at one than the other and ended up just concentrating on the one. But Conley really stuck with them both for quite some time. He was in the Celtics rotation for three title teams, from 59, 60, and 61. Then he pitched for the Milwaukee Braves in the 1957 World Series and was a four-time All-Star as a baseball pitcher. So for an athlete of that combined skill set, there really haven't been any that accomplished what he did. So Gene Conley passed away. Another that passed in July was a center named Daryl Imhoff. And what's interesting about Imhoff is he played at Cal in 1959. He was the center on their 1959 championship team, their NCAA champs, for Pete Newell, and then joined that 1960 Olympic team, which a lot of people think was the first dream team because it had Oscar Robertson, Jerry Lucas, Jerry West, and Pete Newell was the coach. And Imhoff wasn't a Hall of Fame talent like those guys, but a very solid post player that did a lot of the dirty work, rebounded, set screens. Pete Newell knew what he would get out of Imhoff since he coached him in college. So very solid guy that played on some great winning teams. The other interesting tidbit about Imhoff was that he was the opposing center in the game where Wilt Chamberlain scored 100 points. So he was by now in the NBA playing for the New York Knicks and was matched up against Wilt the Stilt in that famous game in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And then ironically, later in his career, he was traded for Wilt Chamberlain. So as a L.A. Laker, Imhoff was traded with a couple other players. The most notable was Archie Clark, who did go on to be an all-star, but they were traded to Philadelphia to get Wilt from Philadelphia out to the Lakers. So interesting journey for Daryl Imhoff and a couple of connections to Wilt the Stilt.
You know why, really quickly, let me just jump in really quick. Why was Wilt Chamberlain traded in the first place? Why would you trade a talent of his caliber from Philadelphia to Lakers?
Well, I wasn't totally aware at the time, but I think things had just sort of run their course for Wilt in Philadelphia. They had that great team in 1967 that won the title, and one of the few times they snuck in there when the Celtics didn't during the 60s. And I think it was a combination of Wilt demanding to move on, and as we've seen over the decades, and maybe we're going to see it again with LeBron coming out to L.A. for the last phase of your career is not a new trend. Wilt did it. Kareem demanded it. So I think it was a combination of that, and things had just kind of run their course for him in Philadelphia with the 76ers.
The siren of the Pacific and the West Coast is called many great players, and I think you're right. I think LeBron will be the next in a long line, from Wilt Chamberlain to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to the list just goes on and on.
Right. Well, here's a couple more. We lost a legendary coach in July. So before there was Red Auerbach, Red Holtzman, Pat Riley, Phil Jackson, Popovich, there was John Kundla. So he was the first NBA dynasty coach. So those Minneapolis Lakers teams with George Mikan and other Hall of Famers like Vern Nicholson and Jim Pollard and Slater Martin, their coach was John Kundla. So won five NBA titles for the Minneapolis Lakers. So
oh, my gosh.
He actually he lived to 101. He was 101 years old when he passed in July.
Wow.
And as a relatively young man, when the Lakers moved from Minneapolis to Los Angeles, Kundla opted not to uproot his family and move with the team to L.A. So he ended up staying and became a college coach at the University of Minnesota there in Minneapolis. But obviously this is the Pioneer era, and a lot of fans of today can't really grasp, you know, how these players might have competed with today's players, and probably most of them couldn't, just with the athleticism. And although I think some would. I have a good friend that was a teenager and an usher at those Minneapolis Lakers games, a friend of mine up in Los Angeles, and he says Jim Pollard was very athletic and would be able to play with today's NBA players. And I think some of the other ones, like Mike, and would have probably adjusted, but probably wouldn't have dominated, obviously. It was, you know, basically pre-integration in that league as well, so a lot of variables. But for what he was tasked to do, and, you know, to go out and win games, John Kundla certainly got it done and was really the first great coach in NBA history.
Definitely a different era then when you think about what you said there. I mean, can you imagine a coach with, you know, the Supersonics when they moved from Seattle to Oklahoma City saying, sorry, I don't want to uproot my family. I'm going to coach a local college team. I mean, goodness gracious, it's amazing to think that, but what a story. Great stuff there, Tim.
Right. Another basketball legend we lost in August was Tom Hawkins, who actually for a lot of our listeners with Chicago roots, he's originally from Chicago, Parker High School, which is now Robeson High School. And he was the first African-American star in basketball at Notre Dame. So he ended up playing at Notre Dame and then had a 10-year NBA career, mostly with the Lakers. In fact, he played five times in the NBA Finals for the Lakers and lost to the Celtics each time. So the misery that Jerry West often talks about, Tom Hawkins was there. And Hawkins actually started his career with the Lakers way back in Minneapolis, actually. Then had a little stint with the Cincinnati Royals and then finished his career when the Lakers had moved back to L.A. But the other thing that's kind of notable about him is that he got into broadcasting and communications after his playing career. Very personable guy, very articulate. And he ended up becoming the vice president of communications for the Dodgers. So even though he was a pro basketball player, he had a long career in L.A. as a community relations and communications representative for the Dodgers. And part of it came out of the whole Al Campanis with Ted Koppel, and he said some politically incorrect things about minorities, and the Dodgers were looking for someone to kind of have a little better public relations tone and someone that was loved in the community. And so Tom Hawkins was very well known then later in his life, being an ambassador for baseball and the Dodgers. So he passed away in August.
Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, and then the last two are fairly recent. In August, we lost two legendary college coaches, Judd Heathcote, who coached Michigan State, among other places, but obviously best known for being Magic Johnson's college coach at Michigan State, passed away. I believe he was 90. And then also Raleigh Massimino, who, of course, best known for Villanova's 1985 perfect game that they managed to play against Georgetown and Patrick Ewing to win the NCAA championship. So both of them passed in August. And, you know, what's interesting about those two coaches is the way they entered the business. And they started as high school teachers and coaches and kind of took the long road, basically, and didn't have that great success till somewhat later in their careers. And you know, today, probably a young coach gets aligned with a, you know, elite coach like a Tom Izzo, for example, or a Rick Pitino, or whoever it may be, and kind of takes the fast track through coaching. Not many of them are probably coaching junior high and high school and teaching a history or English class and then kind of slowly working their way up the coaching ladder. So probably neither of them set out to be NCAA championship coaches, that would have been a dream, I suppose. But just interesting that coaches of that era of those styles are probably not something we're going to see much of anymore. The other thing that was interesting about Massimino is his first 2 years at Villanova. I looked at his year by year. He was 7-19 and 9-18 in his first 2 years at Villanova, which I think in today's world that would get you fired.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. What kind of coach was Massimino? Was he known for the defensive end, offensive end? I never really got a handle on what he was as a coach.
Right. Well, he certainly had a strong personality, and a lot of energy on the sidelines. But just as he was able to do in the upset against Georgetown, a very solid tactician. And in those days, you could kind of slow the game down. There wasn't a shot clock. And so, I think it was a combination of, he was kind of a Jim Valvano-ish kind of, his sideline antics kind of overshadowed his how astute he was with the X's and O's, right? He was, his hair was kind of messed up. He's, throwing off his jacket, loosening his tie, barking at the officials, stomping along the sidelines. But while that show was going on, his teams were very disciplined and executed quite well. And then he was actually coaching up through last year. I think it was a Division II school in Florida. So he'd still been coaching, and you'd see him at the – I don't recall seeing him at the Final Four in Phoenix this past year, but as you know, I've been to many Final Fours and go to the coach's headquarters hotel. So he was always quite a presence there with his energy. And same with Judd Heathcote in his younger days. They, legendary storytellers and were very good about helping mentor younger coaches. In fact, when Heathcote retired, he's from up near Spokane, Washington area originally. He retired to that area, and I know he regularly would meet with Mark Few from Gonzaga and kind of took him under his wing as a guide and mentor.
My biggest memory of Judd Heathcote, unfortunately, was I was a huge U of I fan, obviously, University of Illinois, and they played Michigan State in the mid-80s. I don't remember exactly what year it was, but there was a play where they were losing. He was frustrated. The ball rolled out to him, and he was so angry that he slammed the ball with two hands on the court, and the ball bounced up and hit him right in the face. And he clearly wasn't expecting to do that. And I still grin and laugh a little bit to this day with that memory of him almost knocking himself out by slamming the ball on the ground and having him hit him right in the face. And he had a red nose for the entire rest of the game. But obviously a great coach who is probably most remembered for coaching the NCAA champs with Magic Johnson in 1979 to their victory over Larry Bird in Indiana State.
Absolutely. And he had very good teams at Michigan State after that. In fact, I was communicating a little bit with John Paxson and mentioned the Heathcote passing away and kind of shared a story of a mutual friend of ours that actually got recruited out of Dayton, Ohio, when Heathcote was coaching at Montana. And a real short version of the story, so my buddy flew out to Missoula for the recruiting visit, and his audition, I guess you'd say, was a Saturday morning workout against the current Montana team. Well, the guy that was guarding him was a then-unknown Michael Ray Richardson. So my buddy Mike Lee was a very talented player and ended up playing at the University of Dayton, but Michael Ray Richardson's like 6'5", long arms, went on to be one of the top defensive players, steals, a defensive blanket, basically. So my buddy, it was hard to look impressive with Michael Ray Richardson guarding you. Within a couple years from then, Michael Ray Richardson's lighting it up to the Knicks in Madison Square Garden, but at the time was kind of an under-the-radar guy playing for Heathcote at Montana. So kind of a funny story there with Michael Ray and playing for Heathcote. So he had a pretty elite point guard even before Magic, but it was a little more under the radar at Montana.
Good stuff. Tim, awesome stories as usual. Love having you on. We're almost almost to the start of the season. I'm so pumped up for you know, training camp to begin and finally talking about some real basketball. Love having you on. Looking forward to chatting with you throughout this upcoming season, brother. Have a good one, my friend.
Okay, Fred, you do the same, and I look forward to talking to you soon.